Today we're going to talk about calibration, and calibration is something that is usually not very much taught, but used in much scientific work. And for that reason, I've decided to put it into the curriculum. So, but before we get to that, I have many other things I want to say. So we're going to end with calibration, and we're also going to end with an exercise in calibration. So let's start. The yesterday's exercise was on the Fisher discriminant. And the Fisher discriminant was simply a way of linearly combining variables to make the most discriminant single variable that you could get out of it, given that you just had to optimize to separate things. And people asked, where is it different from a linear discriminant analysis? Well, that's what it is. Where is it different from a principal component analysis? Well, it's different from a PCA in that here we have a data set where we know the labels. We know what is A and we know what is B, who are healthy or ill, or whatever you're dividing between. Whereas in a PCA, this is unsupervised. You do not have the labels. You simply say which direction divides the sample into two that have a much smaller variance in that direction. And then you take orthogonal directions until you have them all lined up in decreasing separation. We'll return to the PCA. And well, how did you code things up, and what was the smartest way? And here I can just say we will post solutions for that. However, a quick look at a solution looks something like this for the two hardest of the irises to separate. So while there was no clear separation in the four-dimensional space where you could see two dimensions at a time, when you combine all four, there's very little overlap. So if you, for example, cut here at zero, and we've moved things around so this makes it zero, well, then you would have two wrong one way and one wrong the other way. So these are what I would consider sort of low error rates of type one and type two. So, but we'll be sure to send that around. Yeah, so that was the Fisher. And what the Fisher really was to sort of get the hang of the idea of large dimensional spaces, or just multidimensional spaces. The fact that when you have more than one number recorded per event or per patient or per case, then things get complicated, because which of these do you use and how do you use them? It's not that simple. So the Fisher is a nice way of boiling things down into one variable, but well, there are many more, and this is where machine learning sort of takes over. All right, then speaking of the PCA, I wanted to introduce you to another one of the, I would call, heroes of statistics, Carl Pearson. And when we talk about the Pearson correlation coefficient, then that's because of him. Sorry, when we're talking about the chi-square, in fact, it's another Pearson behind the linear correlation. But behind the simple and elegant chi-square, that's him. And of course, he was aware of the possible pitfalls, namely that when you have low number of events in a histogram, then the Gaussian assumption breaks down. But also he was aware that the method is remarkably resilient. Now, regarding low statistics, reading all of your projects, sometimes there are four measurements with four uncertainties, and then they're combined and people say, oh, one of them is bad, I'm gonna throw it out. And that's all right if the chi-square sort of points to that direction. And people then blame low statistics. But remember, what we have in mind when we talk about low statistics is a low counting number, because a low counting number is one where the Gaussian assumption of uncertainty breaks down. It's Poisson distributed, and only at sort of reasonable numbers above 10 or 20 is the Gaussian assumption very good. Whereas for low numbers, counting numbers, statistics can be tougher. Now, it actually happens that Carl Pearson was also the person introducing the idea of the principal component analysis in 1901. Little did he know how much that was going to be used by many and, have successors to it today. I'll mention that briefly when we get to the machine learning part. All right. Then I want to say something about project peer evaluation, because one of the things that I want you to, if not learn, then at least have tried, is to evaluate the works of others. And the place to do so is exactly your projects. And I mentioned it also when we were doing the projects. The idea being that I want you to take someone else's project and try to sit and read it through. And I mean, the subject should be no surprise, but now it's up to you to see if you feel that the other group did things in a correct manner, and if you can even spot if it's in a correct manner or not. And so you should do that by Friday. We are fighting to get everything ready for Friday, where I still plan to go through the projects and their evaluation and everything. But I want you to switch with other groups. And then you might say, who are the other groups? Don't worry, we'll send you a mail. We'll send a mail to group one and two together with the projects of group one and two attached. And now you should take the other project and just sit and read it through with a red pen, or actually much better, putting electronic comments in, both for things that are great, praise, and here, keep in mind what you did yourself, they will be sitting with yours, and also where you have questions or comments. And then send that back to the other group. And whether you do it as a group that sits down and evaluates, or if you do it a single person, well, that's perfectly all right. But you should do it, and especially if you want others to comment back on your work, then you should send to the others. And so that's going to be a step towards Friday. And we'll write more out today. And then a lot of people have been talking about coding and what part that plays in sort of modern day data analysis. It plays a great deal of influence. And there are many quotes, some of which I'll just share with you briefly, which I hope gives an insight on how to code. So first of all, I note that, it is practically impossible to teach good programming style to students who have had prior exposure to BASIC. As a potential programmer, they're mentally mutilated beyond hope of regeneration. And the computer scientist who said that, well, I can say I was brought up with BASIC, and perhaps I'm mutilated in that way. But the idea of it is that in courses like DATIF and elsewhere, clever people are trying to introduce the line of thinking that needs to go on behind in order to become reasonably good at programming. And you will always be brought up in one line of thinking, and then within the next 10 years, some other line of thinking will come about. And so what you should really take away here is, okay, I need to be good at learning new things like programming languages. So either you are not that proficient in Python and you should strive to get a little better, not be afraid of throwing yourself at it. And if you're very good, well, just look about, surely new things will come about that will challenge your line of thinking. The next one is measuring software productivity by lines of code. It's like measuring progress on an airplane by how much it weighs. The shorter, the simpler, and the more well-described your code is, the better. And you will be surprised to find that your own code you won't understand in 3 months. So please give it longevity, long lifetime, because you will return to similar problems. And then finally, when documenting things, well, I've never met a human being who would want to read 17,000 pages of documentation. And if there was, I'd kill him just to get him out of the gene pool. Long documentation is usually not worthwhile. And for that reason, again, write things short and clear. And also, we've made the external functions, which you might say, oh, it's a black box. I don't know what's going on there. I don't want to use it. To some extent, we want it also to be a source of inspiration for you to build your own external functions, where you sort of build up almost a library of things you think, oh, this works nice, or this I do often in my field. Because putting some of your code in an external function makes the code simpler, and it makes it modular, and it makes it transportable to new problems without importing all sorts of crap things that you don't need in the new problem. So for that reason, consider sitting down and cleaning up at least just once a program so that you actually put the good function that you have somewhere in an external function, see that it works and runs, and then import it when you're doing another project that looks like this. All right, enough of all this. Let's go to today's subject. And today's subject is calibration. And what is calibration? Well, it's not that easy to define. Of course, people have tried, and the closest thing I found was from the International Bureau of Weights and Measures. And it's I'll gladly read it, operation that under specified conditions in a first step establishes a relation between the quantity values with measurement uncertainties provided by measurement standards and corresponding indications which associated measurement uncertainties of the calibrated instrument or secondary standard. And in a second step, uses this information to establish a relation for obtaining a measurement result from an indication. That was a long sentence, I would say. I've tried to shorten it to operation that under specified conditions, I like that opening, do one of two things. Either establishes a relation between the quantity of interest and associated information. You want to measure A, but that's hard, but you can measure A by measuring B, and B is easier to measure, and you know the relation between A and B. Or B, use this information to correct or improve the estimate of the quantity of interest. So let's say that A and B are related, and then you find a better relation that does not give biases or unnecessary uncertainty. Well, then you've come up with a better calibration. That's what you want to do. And let's just take some examples. Here I found three examples, which just goes to show that calibration is many things, and each field has its own trick of the trade. This image is from the Mars rover Curiosity. And what they have on the side is just a small panel with red, green, blue, and three other colors that look much like the surface of Mars, a scale and size. And now the camera of Curiosity can take a picture of this regularly. And then if the colors have changed, they can see it from here. If length scales have changed, they can see it from here, or all other sorts of things. So in this way, they can calibrate using an image of this. So that's one thing. Here's from chemistry. where you want to measure the concentration in of something, and well, doing that is expensive and hard and so on. But if you add fluorescence to it, then you can measure the concentration by measuring the fluorescence. That's a lot easier. So you measure the fluorescence and then you find out what's the concentration. And as you see here, all right, it's almost linear, but there's an offset here and it bends up here. Okay, so calibration is establishing this relation and making it more and more precise. Here's from particle physics. I found an example from my competitor experiment called CMS. And they measure time. And they do that in an uncalibrated way to begin with. And that gives sort of the red curve. So at what time did we have a collision? At what time should the particles arrive to the calorimeter? When should we read out the calorimeter? And in red is shown what you get if you don't do any corrections. But if you calibrate, well, then things improve. First of all, the mean moves over so that you actually get something that's centered around zero. And secondly, it becomes sharper. You measure time sharper. So yeah, you've calibrated and things have improved. Now, what do you need to consider? Well, again, calibration spans a wide variety of things, but some general considerations are: you typically use a control sample or group. In medicine, you find a group of those who do not have the disease and see if there's an impact, or they feel an impact of some medication compared to those who have it. You also do a control sample where everybody was perhaps ill, but you only get half some working medicine to see how well it works. There's a lot of ethics in this, and people, now I just took it as an example. Typically in particle physics, well, if you're searching for a decay that's super rare, but you have a decay that looks like it, which is not so rare, well, then on the not so rare, you can practice and you can sharpen and you can calibrate on that. And once you feel confident that you're good at looking at this type of event, well, then you go look at other invariant masses, wherever you want to look. So the purpose is to ensure that there's not some inherent bias, because if there was an inherent bias on the way you do your analysis, then you should see it on the control sample. And the aim is to have a good control sample that is large, so small statistical fluctuations, and looks more or less exactly like the signal. And by exactly, well, it doesn't look exactly because then you can't distinguish it, but it might be that it's very, very simple things that makes a difference and things that can be well measured and things that are independent of what you're looking at. And that's what makes it a trick of a trade for each of the fields of science you're in. An example could be people without the signal disease and spanning the same lifestyles. So you can't have that your control sample is very different from the real signal. If it is, well, then you can't be sure that whenever you don't see an effect in one group, that there isn't an effect in another. All right. Then also just considering results for already well-determined quantities. When you have a new detector, try to measure something that is already known. I think that goes for almost everything. We know that a chalk pill without anything in it ain't gonna do much for humans. Well, try it out on a lot of humans and see if it doesn't do anything. Here's an example. And finally, determining a relation to a well-measurable quantity. So you want to infer A, but you have to measure B. Often it's not only a matter of it's impossible to measure A, so we're going to measure B, but maybe it's just expensive to measure A, so we're going to do B instead. And I think a funny example of that is measuring the flow of liquid in a pipe, because people had these flow meters and they were mechanical and they broke all the time and they were expensive to produce and they were expensive to fix and they would break regularly. And then somebody realized that because of turbulence, you can just put a microphone next to the pipe and the noise alone will give you the flow. And so you don't interfere with anything. It's just a running thing. I think carbon 14 dating is one of the great examples of, well, I can't measure the age of this damn thing, whatever it is. I found a bone. Is it old? Is it not? But I can measure the carbon 14 quantity in it, and that I can relate to the age. And so here, people started out by saying, all right, it's an exponential function. The lifetime, well, the halftime is about 5,000 years. And so when I measure how much is in a sample, then from just this exponential, well, the theoretical curve, I can determine how old things are. And the test samples used here were from old Egypt, where they could see, all right, we knew when King Xhosa was king, and then we take a small sample. And they did that. They even did it with redwood trees, some of which are 2,500 years old, a 2,000-year-old Bible. And then tree rings, because you can count the rings in a tree, so you know which part of it is how old. And you can actually establish that way back. And not only can you count the tree rings, but the cool thing is, if you have a piece of wood that spans maybe 20 years, you can see 20 rings in a row. Well, then it turns out that the rings don't have the same distance between them. In years with a lot of rain and sun, the trees grow a lot, and so the rings are wide. And in dry and poor years, they're narrow. And so this is a signature of when it lived. And from going back with trees overlapping, people have made sort of tables of tree ring widths, as you can see, about 1500 years back in time. So when you find a piece of wood, if you can see the rings and measure them, then typically you can date it that way. Of course, carbon dating has shown with the help of all of this that, well, this is how well it can be done. But there's an intercalibration curve, because there's a theoretical curve, but from finding more and more things that you could test this with, it was possible to see that, all right, you can you can actually say, but you need to correct a little bit here. And then Steen says, I hope they have computers to count those rings. Well, typically it's not the count. You might find a piece of wood that is perhaps from the Viking age, and you can see 15 rings. It's not hard to count to 15, but that doesn't tell you how old it is. But when you have all the rings back 1500 years, then you can see where the ring widths matches in a row, and then you can date it. So that's what's done. One thing that offset the carbon 16 dating was nuclear testing. So when people did that, suddenly there was a spike in how much you get of different things. And now you have to correct for that as well. So that is calibration. And it enters many places in our lives without us knowing. For example, GPS, the GPS is reasonably accurate. But what if you need it to very accurate? What can you then do? Well, then you can do what's called a differential GPS. So for example, for landing a plane, you don't want it to be much further than a meter off. Now, GPS inherently isn't that accurate, and especially didn't used to be. But what you could do was say, I have a receiver in the plane and a receiver on the ground, and I will measure exactly where this receiver on the ground is. And then as it gets a GPS signal, it can say, okay, 3 meters north, 5 meters west, and 1 meter below is the offset. So when the plane meshes its position with the same GPS signal, then it knows that offset and can use it. Again, a known source where you can see all the biases, well, that's how you can calibrate. In astronomy and astrophysics, I think one of the interesting cases has been the Type 1a supernovae, which are assumed to be the same. But when you observe them, they happen not to be the same. So you get all these different light curves out. But once you calibrate, you actually see that they all follow the same light pattern as a function of days. And you use those to probe very large distances and also the fate of our universe. So now I'm going to take an example that corresponds very much to today's exercise. So what do we have here? Well, here we have something that looks uniform and then it has some peak in the middle. All right. And here we're trying to measure X. But every time we measured X, which might be a position, then we also measured the temperature in the room or some other quantity Y, which has a tendency to smear out X. So in reality, what happens is that this is X and this is Y, and X changes as a function of Y. And for that reason, even if the peak could be sharp, it isn't. It's very much smeared out here simply because we have some distorting media or distorting variable Y. Now, but what if you have a lot of measurements like this? Well, then you see that pattern. You see that for high Y, X is shifted upwards, and for low Y, X is shifted downwards. And I've just taken the most simple case, namely, all right, fit it here. So what would I do if I had 1,000 known cases and wanted to make this a better case? Well, I would say, all right, I fit this with a line. How would I go about doing that? Well, it's not that simple, but what you can do is say, give me here. Well, now it's filled out with noise from all sorts of other things, which makes it hard. But let's say that there was very little noise in the background. Then you can say between 80 and 85, I take all the points and I take the mean and the standard deviation and divide it by n, and then I get 1 point here. Then I get 1 point here, and then I get 1 point here. And now you get to see how X varies with Y. Right? So the thing we want to do is get the calibrated X, which is the measured X, and then some correction, which depends on Y. And in this case, this turns out to be a reasonable correction. When Y is midway, there's no correction. And if it's zero, it's 20 off that way. And if it's zero, if it's one, then it's 20 off that way. So 40 in front. Then let's say we do that correction. What do things then look like? Well, now they look like this. Because all those points down here were moved in here. All those up here were moved in here. And so now when we plot X calib, oof, we get a sharp peak. Our instrument suddenly works much better. And hey, we can do all sorts of new measurements with it. And that's the aim. If you have a sample where you can establish the relation between X and Y, for example, well-measured cases, then you can calibrate. And in today's exercise, you've found a new way of measuring the distance to a star. But it depends on the temperature and the atmosphere and, you know, all sorts of things. However, you have 10,000 stars for which you know the temperature and the atmosphere and all of these things when you measured them, and you know what distance measure you got, but you also know the true distance measured by other people with other methods before in a long and tedious way. So now you want to do that. And that is today's exercise, and it resembles this almost exactly. So if you struggle with the exercise, try to go back here and look at it. And I've been kind enough to make things, you know, without a lot of background. I've been evil enough not to make it linear. But remember, a linear approximation is still better than not calibrating at all. So when you don't feel that you have exactly the right sort of functional form for this, don't despair. Doing some calibrations better than not. And just to round off then on calibration, so it's usually a central part of data analysis in order to establish that measurements are correct, or correct them if they're biased, and also simply to make your analysis better so that you minimize uncertainties. And I can say that for scientific instruments, usually the best calibration is the one that results in the instrument working the sharpest, which in turn results in being best at discovering new things. And that's why it plays an essential role. But it also plays an essential role in all sorts of industry where it is known that we want to measure this thing, but we need to correct it because if you're in marketing, well, you know, it was Easter and then people behave like that. We know that from last year. If you're in medicine, well, we test more people for corona. But why does the number positive not go up with the number of tests we do? Well, that's probably because those who come first are those who are most likely to be ill, and that the probability of actually being infected drops as we test more and more. So then you establish a relation. Okay, it's only to the power of 0.7 or whatever your model looks like. That's at least our current best model we have in the expert group. So all of these effects are things that you do to make your data, your vision sharper. And that is calibration. And that distinguishes the good experiment. All right. That's it. Questions or comments? Please fire away. Thank you, Marcus. I'd rather have, well, questions are very welcome. So, and I can then, while you perhaps still think, say that some of you who work in the experimental groups around the Institute or elsewhere, in the future will or maybe won't, well, I hope that you will see that this calibration of your measurements is one of the driving forces behind getting things to work in an optimal way. And this is where you then take data and this is what you publish. The sharpest peaks showing your capability. All right, can you repeat what happened at the calibration example before? Yeah, I'm just going to repeat. So we measure X and we see, all right, we expect perhaps a peak around 100. We don't know if it's 100 or not, if there's a peak at all, but we see something. And then we say, okay, look, we can see a peak with our new fine $1 million instrument. But then somebody says, yeah, but are you sure that it doesn't change its output X with Y? Y, for example, being the temperature, probably. Something more or less obvious. And then you say, okay, let's measure a lot of X values and at the same time measure the temperature and plot that. And then you see this. And you see that the measurement is smeared out here wide by the fact that, sure, the X value changes with Y. It seems X can be measured very well, but it's just affected by something. And never mind the background. So we do a fit to this greenish, yellowish line here. And we realize, if we, instead of X measured, use X measured minus 40 times Y minus a half, then we get a calibrated X, which does not suffer from this effect. So that should be a better way of measuring. And lo and behold, when that's what we plot here, suddenly we get a super sharp peak at 100, you know, no doubt compared to before. And so we've calibrated and our instrument simply, well, our data is better as a function of doing that. And then now my next question is, okay, can this be sharper? Because something also smears it called Z. I don't know what Z is, but maybe it smears it out. And can we calibrate that? It's now Xcalib on the x-axis here. Yeah, and here. I should write, you're right. It's X as calibrated. Yeah. Yeah, so you're right, Steen. There's no rule for calibration. It's whatever improves it, I would say. Okay, so there's that. Is that in it? But the rule of thumb is that you plot a known quantity and compare it to as a function of some value. And if you see that your known quantity is 10% off when temperature is high, well, then correct with 10% back when temperature is high. Now, and Peter asks, is it still the same variable we measure? Yeah, you keep measuring X. You can't change your measurement X. And then would the conclusion be the same if we found a peak in X measured and in peak calib? Well, we do find one in X measured and in X calib. And the reason why we feel certain that the calibration worked is because the peak became sharper. Sometimes you will experience that you maybe for some argument think, we should plot this calibration variable instead of what we measure. And then you plot it and it's even worse than that. Or you have something sharp and then you calibrate it wrongly and it starts looking like this. But fortunately you can from the data determine, well, the width and see if it became sharper. Is it the residual you have in the 2D plot then? No, it's actually not the residual. It's a 2D, you measure X and you measure Y and they distribute themselves like this. And Peter, but somehow you're now measuring the variable you measure, but minus some other variable. Yeah. All right, let me try again. Let's say that our apparatus can measure X, that might be amount of radiation. And then we give it a source, put it next to and say, now we should measure 100. Otherwise our apparatus is not very smart. And we're about to send it into space, whatever we're doing. We see that if the temperature is low, then it measures 80. If the temperature is high, it measures 120. That's not good. It should measure 100 always because temperature should not depend, radiation should not depend on temperature. And then somebody realizes, but since we know that we should measure 100 always, we can just correct back. What is the correction? Well, it's then going to be this. We can measure that in the data because we have a control sample. We have somewhere where we know the answer. And now we do that. And then henceforth, we use this Xcalib as the best output we can do with our instrument, which now measures both the amount of radiation and the temperature, and then comes out with an idea of what the radiation really is. So the idea of 100 being correct here is based on the fact that you put a calibration source next to it. So there are cases you know, and that's also the case in today's exercise. I give you 10,000 cases you know. Or is it 1,000? Yeah. Did that summarize things in a way that is to everybody's satisfaction. All right, good. Then good long break, stretch your legs, get some tea, and nothing will be happening here until at least 2:15, 20 minutes break. See you around.